ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, you'll be hearing about my experiences and listen to my exclusive audio recordings from the 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival.
Let's gather where laughter meets love. The 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival, April 6th through the 9th in Hollywood. Featuring a 50th anniversary world premiere restoration of The Graduate and an opening night screening of In the Heat of the Night, attended by Sidney Poitier, director Norman Jewison, and producer Walter Mirisch. Plus, red carpet excitement and a full slate of exclusive events at Club TCM. Let's movie. The 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival, April 6th through the 9th in Hollywood. For passes and more, go to tcm.com/festival.
I was fortunate to cover the red carpet this year as TCM honored the 50th anniversary of Sidney Poitier's In the Heat of the Night. Though I wasn't able to get inside the screening, I got to interview several celebrity attendees. The first audio you'll hear is my interview with Joel McRae's grandson, Wyatt.
Hello, it's great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
What's your name?
Kristen.
Hey Kristen, I'm Wyatt.
The theme of this festival is Make 'em Laugh. Right. And of course, Joel McRae has a couple movies playing this year. So what is it about something like The Palm Beach Story, him as a comedic actor, that you think endures today?
I think just humor in general endures throughout time. You know, I mean, whenever you can make people laugh, I think that's a wonderful thing. And you know, it gives people something to look forward to. It helps them forget about their daily lives, you know, to a certain degree. And I think Palm Beach Story, Preston Sturges wrote it in such a way that it could happen today. I mean, that movie could be remade today and it would be just as fun as it was back then.
Say the same thing about something like Sullivan's Travels, which is my favorite.
Well, Sullivan's Travels is my personal favorite too.
I know Joel didn't like working with Veronica Lake, who I love so much, but you know, I think that works to the film's favor.
Yeah, they were really great on screen, you know, and of course they made another movie called Ramrod Left.
They did.
And they had great on-screen chemistry, even though she might have frustrated him a little bit.
She frustrated everybody, so. Whether modern day or classic, make you laugh.
You know, I like the classics, really, to be honest with you. I mean, the more the merrier, the more is a classic, I think. But, you know, there's some great comedians today. I mean, you know, Vince Vaughn does some funny stuff. You know, it's, you know, I don't like so much the raunchy side of that, but there are some great moments in, you know, Vince Vaughn and Will Ferrell, some of those films that are just, they're classic lines, you know. And so I think today's audience relate to that a little bit more, you know. Obviously, the older films, you have to use your imagination a little bit more because they
right.
don't lay it out there, you know, quite the way they do today.
Exactly.
But I like that aspect.
You'll hear more red carpet coverage later in this episode, as well as in next week's show. But next, you're going to hear guest Carrie Beacham introduce Jean Harlow's 1932 film Redheaded Woman. You might remember the interview that I conducted with Beacham last year for Trailblazing Women, and she's just as fun as ever. I've watched Redheaded Woman before, but this viewing was particularly special because I made time to see the Hollywood Museum exhibition about Harlow, curated by Ticklish business friend Daryl Rooney. If you want to know more about Daryl Rooney and the exhibition, be sure to listen to my special Jean Harlow tribute episode. Seeing her costumes, diaper pins, pictures, and more at the exhibit really brought her to life. It was a feeling that was enhanced during the film. Redheaded Woman isn't my favorite Jean Harlow feature, but watching it here took on added significance. Let's give Carrie a listen.
Thank you guys, and all I've got to say is Jean Harlow. Oh, she's lovely. This is just so great. And I love Redheaded Woman. I mean, I'm a proselytizer for this film. I go around, like, you haven't seen Redheaded Woman? Oh my God. You know, obviously, for somebody as hardcore as me, I don't even let those feminist filters in. I just love this movie. And I don't say that often. You know, jeans that are sparkling best. And I also kind of have a thing with Chester Morris. But anyway. The story of how this movie got made, all the hoops it went through, is an example of the studio system at the time, how the best movies, I think, come together in the most serendipitous sometimes, and how MGM created a hit film that helped usher in the enforcement of the production code. Now, it all started in a sleepy little, well, anyway, written by Catherine Brush. She was called the Wicked Lady Novelist. And her latest novella was The Red-Headed Woman. It began to be serialized in the Saturday Evening Post before it was later published as a book. And the MGM story department grabbed it before they knew what the story actually was. Now, upon reading it in its entirety, they realized they had bought a straight melodrama about a conniving Midwest sex cop. So it would not make a particularly good film, nor, but it would also be hell to get through the Hayes office. And this I never understood. F. Scott Fitzgerald was assigned to write the script. But somehow, he failed to get the twist that it needed, obviously. MGM's production chief, Irving Thalberg, pronounced, "Oh my God, Scott's turned a silly book into a tone poem." The production had been announced to ride the wave of popularity the story had enjoyed in serialization, and the publicity department was busy promoting a search for the redheaded woman to bring the story to the screen. Clara Bow, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, even Garbo were mentioned in the press. As so many tests were being made, the Marine wrestler jokingly posed for photos wearing a red wig. Now, Thalberg needed a new writer, and he needed one in a hurry. And he knew he also needed somebody who really understood wit and could come up with the zingers. The one person who could pull it off was the woman H.L. Mencken had called the first American writer ever to poke fun at sex, Anita Loos. Now, it turned out Thalberg's timing for once was perfect. Anita had been writing scripts since 1912, penned the comedies that rose Doug Fairbanks to stardom, and had written half a dozen plays as well, but she hadn't really written since 1926. She didn't need to. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes had been such a success that she and her husband John Emerson spent some serious time in Europe, New York, Palm Beach. But by the end of 1931, what hadn't been lost in the stock market, her husband had methodically put into annuities with himself as the sole beneficiary. Now, Anita claimed to be relieved when Emerson said, "Bug, one of us is going to have to go back to work." Well, she knew which one it was, and she happily packed for California and MGM. Now, Anita and Thalberg agreed on their slant for the script for Redheaded Woman, and Anita wrote what would have been, what could have been of an also opera, and turned it into a script riddled with double entendres and clever one-liners. Now they needed an actress who could pull it off, and they found her in Jean Harlow. Now, I have to pause here, because we have to appreciate the fact we got the studio, we got the script, we got the cast. Only now does Thalberg say, "What director is available on this?" Those are the days. So they brought in Jack Conway. Now, Conway directed the silent version of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and other successful comedies, but he didn't see anything amusing in the script. He told Anita and Irving, "Look, folks, if you're trying to be funny, I'm here to report a girl like this almost broke up my home." Believe me, it was no joke. Now, Thalberg laughed and thought he could pull it off, but he told him Anita go to the set every day to keep reminding him that the picture's a comedy. So she did, yet another difference from today. Now, Thalberg's attention turned to the Hayes office. Hayes, at this point, we have to remember, was really a lobbyist to the outside world on behalf of Hollywood. He'd been brought in a decade earlier to assure the world it was not Sodom and Gomorrah, and the studios were the ones who paid his $100,000 a year salary. He spent most of his time just walking a tightrope. But he had two men in Los Angeles, the Studio Relations Office, it was called, who genuinely liked movies, Jason Joy and Lamar Trotti. They read the scripts, but more importantly, they watched the films, rough cuts and previews. And they focused on films that they knew from the synopses might be problematic. The synopsis MGM had submitted for Redheaded Woman had passed muster, but the preview Trotti saw upset him, so he went to conference with Thalberg. Hours and hours later, Trotti reported back to Hayes. "Well, Thalberg feels we're 100% wrong in our attitude towards the story, insisting they intend to play the picture as a road burlesque." Well, Hayes was so concerned, he went directly to Thalberg's ultimate boss, Nick Skank. And the last thing, with Albert Monitor, with the New York office involved in script revision. Thank you very much. He assured his gang he would take care of it. He had a plan. Irving knew the film that they had made so far. It took the audiences way too long to figure out Little Andrew's Red. They had to have an opening scene that was so blatant. There was no question about the type of woman she was. Anita went back to her yellow pad, wrote a plug for herself, and a classic sequence. In close-up, Carlo smiles at her own reflection in a hand in the air and rhetorically asks, "So gentlemen prefer blondes, do they?" Cut immediately to a scene in the store's dressing room. Our heroine holds out her skirt, sachets in front of the window, and inquires sweetly of the sales lady, "Can you see through this?" When the off-screen voice responds, "I'm afraid so," Jean breaks into a devastating grin and says, "I'll wear it then." In less than 30 seconds, we know Will Andrews. The audience left absolutely howling. They loved it. The scene also served to establish the burlesque nature of the film that Thalberg had promised the Hayes office, and they were appeased by the revisions, at least temporarily. "We believe the changes make all the difference in the world," Trotty wrote Thalberg. "In fact, the treatment now being used ought to make the picture satisfactory under the code and reasonably safe in censored territories. May I take this opportunity to congratulate you?" But Jason Joy warned Will Hayes directly that, quote, "My feeling is that this picture is either very good or very bad. There being no real halfway business. It's dependent on the point of view of the spectator, who sees it as, they're either going to see it as farce or they're going to see it as heavy sex. Well, enough people saw it as farce to fill theaters to capacity, but enough others, particularly in the South and in the churches, saw it as heavy sex. They complained loudly and voraciously to the Hayes office and to local governments with a renewed demand for official censorship. Women's organizations with, and the Catholic Church close behind made the Hayes office approval of redheaded women into their case in point that Hayes had failed to protect the public. Other studios complained on the side that MGM was getting favorable treatment. Jason Joy privately wrote agonized letters to studio heads that about the economic realities of studios and his personal fear of censorship. But Joy had to admit he'd lost the battle. He resigned, and I love this part, he became an executive of Fox. Lamar Trotty soon followed him out the door, and of course, Joe Breen, in his enforcers of the production code, moved in, loaded for bear and loathing movies. Now, I have to do a little aside here, because the difference in the way they approached it, once Breen got in, his office read every script, every script. They didn't necessarily, in fact, rarely actually saw the films. And that's why clever directors such as Dorothy Arzner could get away with the likes of Dance Girl Dance, portraying the dance instructor as a lesbian through hair and costumes, not in the script, thank you very much, and Lucille Ball's character advertising how she was increasing her income by adding furs and jewels with every appearance on the screen. But, you know, Green's power and the power he had changed the way, it's one of the reasons too, so many of the women writers that I love were finally just like, oh, the hell with that. This is just getting too hard to write the stories we want to write. Now, the silver lining, I want to point out, of the response to Redheaded Woman was when it was released, Charles Boyer was packing to go back to Europe. He said, oh, hell, if I'm only getting cast as a chauffeur, I'm out of here. Well, the fan mail that poured in was enough to make him stay, get him a great contract, and of course, turn him into a major star. Now, with that, enjoy one of my personal favorites, Redheaded Woman.
The next introduction you'll hear is with Leonard Maltin and TCM's head of legal affairs and preservation. Rafter Romance is a Ginger Rogers starring pre-code from 1933 that's been unavailable for viewing for several decades, which Maltin and crew are going to explain in the introduction. I've never watched this film before, but anything with Ginger Rogers is worth seeing, and boy, is this movie a lot of fun. It's saucy, it's romantic, it's filled with great characters. It's amazing how this was ultimately recovered and is finally available to the masses. So let's listen in.
Hello.
Hi! I wanted to ask, we have the iWorks shorts, but no Disney movies this year. How do you feel about that? I guess I'm just used to them having a Disney movie for me to see on the big
screen. I don't think it was a deliberate slap in anybody's face.
No. It is interesting that we get these amazing shorts now to see.
It's a wonderful opportunity to see them restored as they will be, and to have a iWorks granddaughter, Leslie, here to introduce them with my friend Jerry Beck.
Well, and I wanted to throw out, I just saw a Disney movie that I had never seen before called The Sword and the Rose. I'd never seen it before,
and
Disney's British period is
it's an underrated aspect of his career.
It's a very eclectic period. There's really no real through line with a lot other than they're British, and they have British stars, but it's always great to talk to you,
Same
Leonard.
Here.
I am excited to see your talk on Sunday.
Thank you.
Oh, you wanted
This year's festival was all about dearly departed TCM host Robert Osborne, from the Remembering Robert panel to the artwork inside Club TCM. Introducing 1944's Lady in the Dark on Nitrate was former Essentials co-host Rose McGowan, who started her discussion with a moment of silence for Robert. After that, she talked about the film, and let's just say Lady in the Dark is weird and dated. The story is a Freudian look at a woman who has a career and wears masculine clothes, so obviously she's demented. On Nitrate, though, this was flawless, and those costumes McGowan brings up are nothing short of exquisite, more than making up for the film disease. So let's listen in to Rose McGowan.
The Essentials with Robert Osborne, and can currently be seen on Filmstruck as the host of the series Female Friendships, a collection of films focusing on best female friendships in the movies. Her directorial debut, Dawn, premiered to rave reviews at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, and her memoir, Manifesto Brave, is due out later this fall from HarperCollins. Rose McGowan.
Hello, everybody. I just want to take a moment of 5 second silence for Robert Osborne. Is that cool? I just want to think about him at a group level right here with us all right now at the film festival, because his spirit, I feel it here. I feel him in theaters, I feel him in the fans, I feel him when you simply watch TCM. And one of the great differences, I think, about this film festival versus others is that cinema lovers, we come here with open hearts, not coming to criticize. In most film festivals, you're going with an eye out, like, what am I going to see? How can I, what's the deal with this? And here, it's simply out of love. The fact that we get to see a movie from 1944 on original nitrate is insane. They had to build, they have to make a fireproof vault where the projectionist is. So thank you, brave projectionist up there. Lady in the Dark is directed by Mitchell Leeson, and it's interesting because the writer who adapts the film, he was going through therapy, Freudian analysis, at the time of this screenplay adaptation. It's adapted from a Kurt Weill and Gershwin stage show. And it is, most of the songs were cut except for one, Jenny, song for Jenny, and this is an interesting film for me personally because it's mores, or it's you must go to psychoanalysis because you dress in mannish clothes and don't want to get naturally Rose McGowan. But what's cool about this film, besides it being on nitrate and the fact that it was shot on Technicolor, so we still can see a little bit of the glow, the colors that were used. Mitchell Leeson, the director, was also a costume designer and art director initially. And so the costumes in this movie are out of control. I think they used up all of the dry ice in the land when they made this movie, for you'll see in the dream sequences, which are fabulous and filled with dry ice. There was one of Ginger's dresses was, I think it cost $35,000. And it's made up, Universal had a whole wardrobe department, one part of it was for men. And the mink dress became way too heavy because Mitchell Leeson had it made with glass and fake rubies. and it weighed, Ginger couldn't stand. So they made one out of a cage, so if you can spot the differences, look for those. One is with sequins and one is with the jewels, and now I believe the jeweled one is in the Smithsonian. So who says movies don't contribute? It's my honor to introduce The Lady in the Dark and to just have fun. I know that it's different socio-politics now, and that might be a little funny, but laugh when it's funny and don't when it's not, and I think it's great that, you know, even back then they were doing movies exploring. This came out a year before Spellbound, and they were exploring, you know, psychology, and it's pretty interesting to see how Hollywood dealt with the subconscious, and not with dry ice, obviously. Anyway, I hope you all enjoy it. This is Lady in the Dark. And thank you, TCM, for having me out here and for having this amazing festival and gathering like true, true lovers of cinema and who believe in the art of cinema and the legend of cinema. And I think just by us being here tonight, you're all helping to continue that. So thank you.
Moving back to the red carpet, one of my favorite interviews that I did this year was with 2001 A Space Odyssey star Cara DeLay, attending the festival to introduce the 1962 film David and Lisa. DeLay is so great, and even took time to talk about my favorite film of his, Bunny Lake Is Missing. Here's Cara DeLay.
Hey.
Hi!
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm alright.
Well, it's great to talk to you. You're introducing David and Lisa
during
the festival, directed by Frank Perry.
That's right.
Who's kind of infamous in film nowadays. But what was it like to make that movie in 62 and with him? And
it was a work of love. It was, you know, I've done 30 features. And it's right up there with the top one or two. And I'm including 2001 in that.
It was a
very low budget film. It was made for $180,000. Frank Perry raised money like you do a Broadway play. That he had angels, individuals. There was no company involved. He had no distribution. He took the cans of film under his arm, flew and hired someone who could speak Italian, and got it entered personally into the Venice Film Festival. It won a prize, the Opera Prima. With that prize, he was able to get a distribution, and when made it millions, I mean, it just took off, you know, which was, so it was totally responsible for my film career.
Well, I have to ask about one of my favorite movies that you made, which is Bunny Lake Is Missing.
Oh, yeah.
And that movie is Carol Lindley, she's beautiful. And
Laurence Olivier.
That's right. What was
it? Noel Coward.
That's right. You had who's who of amazing people.
And you want to hear
people.
A little funny story about
sure,
Noel Coward?
Sure, please.
I never worked with him in that film. We didn't have any scenes together. I had the day off because he was filming. But I wanted to meet Noel Coward.
Right.
So I went down and I was introduced. Noel Coward, Kier DeLay. And it took him less than a second. He went, Kier DeLay, I'm gone tomorrow.
Wonderful. You wouldn't expect anything less.
Well, that's not the most optimistic thing to say. However, given that it was Noel Coward,
yeah.
I tell that story all over the place.
That movie is very surprising. You kind of play the villain, which was at least surprising to me. So what was...
I've played villains a few times, yeah.
But I think in that one, it's so surprising because you don't expect it,
at least. True. Well, that's what you're supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you.
I was a doting brother.
Exactly. And you know, you sold it. I thought that movie is very underrated. It's a very underrated little gem. So
thank
you so much for stopping.
Pleasure.
It was great to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
And we'll close out this first episode of TCM Film Festival Audio with an extended interview with Michael Douglas following a presentation of 1979's The China Syndrome. Get a copy of this film because it's intense and remarkable with a performance by Jack Lemmon that should have received all the awards. Though I didn't make it out to the actual live from the TCM Film Festival interview that Douglas did, this was more than enough. So let's give a listen to Mr. Michael Douglas.
Noon. We're having a two-hour conversation, which will turn into a television show here on TCM. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor. Michael Douglas. They've just seen a very powerful movie, and you'll correct me, obviously, but the credits were rolling there. There was no music, and there was there no music in the movie? There were some very tense moments, and you guys let that tension happen.
Absolutely right. When we were looking at our final mix and putting the picture together, we had a very impressive composer involved. The director, Jimmy Bridges, and I said, I don't know, and one time they're running the reels and the music track wasn't there, And our ending was working so well, I said, you know, this music is just making what is dramatic, melodramatic. And it became a little silly, and so we took it out, and these are the jobs of like our sound editors. It's such a brilliant job on the clicking of the machines and all these individual sounds. It was much stronger than having the music.
I didn't neglect to mention that you probably figured it out by now. Michael Douglas produced the China Syndrome as well as starring in it. It's also a credit to the performances, namely, I think, of Jack Lemmon and Wilford Brimley sort of in the room in those situations that they are conveying with their eyes. Feel that tension where you expect music, like Lemmon's face is doing the job of what music frequently does in a film.
Jack's a big coffee drinker. I mean, in case one of his incredible ability. Jack would come in, he's one of the smoothest moving guys in the world, all looking effort, and this and that, would literally come in into their rolling, okay, scene 24, take an evening talking to himself, he'd finish his cup of coffee, and he'd put it down, and he'd say, magic time. And that was it, he was there. I had such great emotion for Jack because he hung in with me for over a year with this picture. He was a strong environmentalist, and I was having a struggle in putting it all together. It was getting to be a joke, and me going up, 60 days, Jack, 60 days. You got it, buddy, you got it. And he put off a lot of stuff for over a year before we finally had the green light.
It is, I think, it's surprising to me to hear, and it was to read, and probably to these people, that it was that difficult to get China Syndrome made. Your previous film was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It did rather well.
It doesn't change anything. I mean, we went through a slight turn by going back to Cuckoo's Nest for a second. After all the struggles, get Cuckoo's Nest made by an independent financier. The movie that you saw that won 5 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Director, Actor, Actress, and Screenplay. That movie completely done and finished on its own. We brought down to Los Angeles. Post-production was in Berkeley, California. We had meetings with every studio in this town, and that movie, that final Academy Award picture, was turned down by everyone. It wasn't as if they saw a rough cut, you know, or anything like that. So that was a good insight for me about this town and the businesses, having to commit to what you believe in. Just as people told me, well, who wants to make another Snake Pit for Cuckoo's Nest? I later found out the Snake Pit made a lot of money. Thank you very much. Nobody really wanted to think there was a movie about the meltdown of a nuclear power plant. My interest and involvement was not that. This script came to me unsolicited by a guy named Mike Gray, who was a documentary filmmaker out of Chicago, had done a movie called The Murder of Fred Hampton, Black Panther leader who was murdered by Chicago police. A very controversial picture. Mike's background was as an engineer, and he sent the script, which really read as a brilliant horror movie. And I looked at it as a scary horror movie with this nuclear power plant being the monster. And it was only then after we committed to the picture and got involved with the verisimilitude of nuclear power that I became more of an advocate, and this was really the issue that's defined the rest of my life in terms of the elimination of nuclear weapons.
The script arrived in the mail. Well, I mean, you must get some stuff. Must you come to you in the mail? You don't open it, right? You open everything.
Those days was a little more. I mean, now you're told by your lawyers and everything else, don't touch it. And I, for those that are out there, it is unfortunate. Unsolicited material we do not accept because of the lawsuits and legalities that eventually evolved.
So but in late 70s, you could still open up. Casting, you said Jack Lemmon waited with you for better than a year. Early on, the roles were very different. There was no female reporter at all in the movie, right?
Correct. It was a male reporter, and Richard Dreyfuss was going to play that role. He was on, and then I know it's hard to believe, but I had done a television series as an actor, The Streets of San Francisco.
I don't don't think you need to tell them that.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That'll keep you awake beforehand. And so then, with this big desire to make this movie, Cuckoo's Nest, which then won all the Oscars, and I had gambled and I left my fifth year of the series, which is pretty dangerous. I mean, the show was a big hit. You're crazy? And I said, then. And I was blessed, which is impossible to imagine today, that Carl Malden and Quinn Martin, who was the big-time producer, let me out of my fifth-year contract. You never hear about that stuff today, because they knew how much Cuckoo's Nest meant to me.
You were leaving San Francisco, where that show was shot, flying frequently to L.A. at the end of shooting to have production meetings and working on raising financing for Cuckoo's Nest during shooting Streets of San Francisco.
Yeah, but I was fortunate because my partner, Saul Zantz, was in Fantasy Records in Berkeley. So I was able to go literally sometimes after work across the bridge in pre-production and all of that over to Berkeley. But my point is that after the Cuckoo's Nest, everybody says, you want to act? And I said, well, yeah, I can act. The reality is, it changed just recently, but then, if you were on a television show, it was literally impossible to get to be an actor in movies. The argument was, well, if you're there for free, who's going to pay for you? So before me, it was really only, I think, Steve McQueen and Clint Eastwood who had made the transition going from television to films. The point is, I'm now a producer. I got an office, a production company after Cuckoo's Nest. And the China Syndrome, I saw a part for me because I couldn't be the lead. It could be one of those pictures that I could, you know, have a chance to do. And so I had that part. So it's be the three of us. As Ben and I were talking a little earlier, Richard Dreyfuss had a couple of hits come out, and all of a sudden Richard was gone. Gone. And he'd been spending some time, and he left right close to us getting ready to do this picture. So we were like, scratching our heads with Jimmy Bridges, our director, and a studio executive reminded us. He said, well, you know, Jane Fonda is developing the Karen Silkwood story, and maybe you guys should, these are competing projects, so Jane and I, with our familial histories, sort of sized each other up. It was sort of like she was initially trying to persuade me in some way to kill the China Syndrome so the Karen Silkwood story could go, and I was going to tell her that we were further ahead on China Syndrome. You should, you know, put a dagger in Karen. And eventually it worked out that we were ready to go, and so we changed Richard's role and had it rewritten. Jimmy Bridges, our director, is also an excellent writer, to make a part for Jane.
And you took it really seriously. You studied, you learned what a cameraman in the late 70s, how that cameraman would behave. I spent a long time in local news, and by the time I was there, they weren't like you. But that was good.
I wanted to get the whole feel of it, the size of the cameras. I got together with a cameraman from NBC named Bob Brown, and he showed me all the things. He was a lovely guy. And I can't remember how far after that, but I saw the news one day about this terrible tragedy, massacre by a cult leader named Jim Brown.
Jim Jones.
Yeah. Jim Jones, in, I think it was British Guiana.
Yeah, in Guyana.
In Guyana, a whole bunch of his people were killed by a poison, taking a poison. And one of the other people who was killed was the cameraman, Bob Brown. He was at the airport. We had just finished doing a story on them. He was at the airport. He was murdered at the airport.
Yeah, along with a congressman from the Bay Area, I think Leo Ryan.
Right.
Was coming there to sort of confront Jones because so many of his constituents were in the cult.
That was my connection.
And first weekend, movie comes out March 16th. How was it received? How did it do?
It did okay. It did good. It did, very well, actually. Very well for the kind of picture it was. However, we did held in there for the first week. We did well. Heavily criticized how irresponsible of Hollywood to be doing a film on nuclear power. George Will was super critical and dismissive. Jane Fonda was not a lot of people's favorite person after the Vietnam War. I remember some of the promotion building up to it. General Electric, which also built a lot of nuclear power plants. Took away, I think it was 60 Minutes that they were a sponsor on, refused it.
The campaign against this movie, Michael's underselling it, I think a little bit, was very well organized. It was a corporate energy-based organized protest to beat back this film.
Correct. And so we held in there. That was confirming with me it was 12 days.
12 days later, March
20th. 12 days after the movie opens, Three Mile Island accident happens. I try to explain it was a complete epiphany to me. I'm not a religious person, but I thought somebody's telling me something. And the process began, and nobody knew exactly how serious people watched what could be the China syndrome, could be a meltdown. And there's Walter Cronkite on television with the public relations director of Harrisburg of Three Mile Island saying in a split screen with our actor here on the screen, the PR guy, saying the same thing. The exact same thing. So it got deeper and deeper. In our movie, for our finale, we brought in a couple of General Electric quality assurance experts who had worked in the nuclear power field and then had lost faith, basically really lost faith and went to the other side. And they became our experts in giving us the likely scenario of what would happen. And one of the articles that came out later, so our script was based on 150 computer steps, logical computer steps that would happen, or the mistakes that we made for an accident. Aaron Latham, a writer for Esquire magazine, did a piece, and they analyzed 150 steps in our movie, and over 90% of the steps were exactly what happened at Three Mile Island. So it just got more and more, and people say, wow, that must have really helped your movie. My God, an incredible amount of publicity got exposure. It scared the audience. You know, either people felt that they saw the movie on the news, or they said, I don't know if I want to see this movie. So we did fine. The movie was successful. I think it became part of my history of sort of doing movies that have a sort of a zeitgeist and speaking about what's going on at the time. It has stuck with me as the most incredible moment in my career in terms of tied in what was going on in real time.
We have to wrap this up because we got to get to this other interview, but I will ask Cuckoo's Nest, China Syndrome, again, these are movies about things that matter. There was part of you that was like, look, I also want to make I want to be a romantic hero. I want to do an adventure movie. Do those desires compete? How do you balance that? Because you clearly make pictures that matter, and then you also want to make pictures that, just entertain.
I think I have to really give tremendous credit to the television series. When you do a television series, we were doing a series in San Francisco, so we were filming 6 days a week. Those days we did 26-hour shows in a season, so that's straight. So you're working 6 days a week, 8.5 months straight through. You're looking at these scripts that are coming in, and you get pretty good about structure. And you also get really good about working together as an ensemble. And I take my hat off to Carl Malden, who's such an extraordinary actor and was such a team player, that you learn that you are not the most important thing in the project, that the material is the most important. So I'm an old-fashioned structuralist, and I've learned from the prologue, the three-act epilogue. My first desire, of course, is to be moved, whether it's funny or sad or whatever it is. And then secondly, I analyze the material pretty carefully and see if it's structurally sound. And then my interests are all over the place, depending on where it may be.
Carl Malden gave you some very specific advice. I have it if you don't remember, but it's great. It was in the documentary I saw, and it's in your book, too. You remember what he said to you? He said, Michael, when you make it quickly. And this, meaning Streets of San Francisco, is crap. Good crap, but nonetheless, that's right. Like,
we would, because Carl would had in his contract, when we started a new episode, he would have the next week's episode there. So in between takes, when they were setting up cameras, he used to call me Buddy Boy. He said, get the hell out of here. Buddy Boy? I said, all right, Carl, yes. We'd go into a room and start rehearsing the lines. So the writers hated us because the scripts ran 8 pages longer simply because we picked up our cues, because we knew it and exactly what Carl said, just moving right along. Buddy, buddy boy.
And quickly about Carl, because I know these people care about him. You were the second fiddle supposed to be on that show. There's a great quote I won't get into from Quinn Martin about like why he hires you. But it was Carl Malden's show. You were the number two guy. And by season two, Carl was comfortable letting you have completely equal footing and leading some episodes.
In those days, if you remember those police shows, the second banana was 2 feet back in soft focus. And I'll never forget, it was the early second year, and Carl said, Mike, oh, come on, come on. And he let me, this is the kind of actor he was, and shared. So I think that had the biggest influence on my career.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Douglas.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And because I hit my $5 Patreon goal, I'll be live tweeting an upcoming TCM film, so drop by my Twitter feed to cast your vote for either An Affair to Remember, The Way We Were, The Palm Beach Story, or Creature from the Black Lagoon. Next time, I'll be sharing more audio from the 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival. Till next time.